toward the entrance.
"Write a poem about this," shouted Simba. Beside me, Cinna flinched, and then began to weep. When at last we stepped outside onto the porch of the Senate House, I could wait no longer. I unrolled the blood-smeared piece of parchment. The first word was Greek. Prosoke. Beware. The very word that had been written in the sand in front of Cinna's house. I felt a chill. The next word was also in Greek and meant today. This was followed by a list of names. I whispered as I read them. Marcus Junius Brutus, Decimus Junius Brutus, Gaius Cassius Longinus, Gaius Servilius Casca, Publius Servilius Casca, Lucius Tilius Simba, Gaius Tribonius. There were many more names, all written in very small letters by a very fine hand. Artemidorus, working in the house of Brutus, trusted by him, had become aware of the conspiracy. Somehow, he had even discovered the names of the conspirators and had written them down. And he had decided at the last moment to warn Caesar, but too late. Artemidorus had discovered what I had failed to discover, what Caesar himself had vaguely suspected, what Cicero had suspected as well. Cicero's name was not on the list, a relief to me, if only because it meant that Cicero had not made a complete fool of me by feigning ignorance and playing a part to distract me. "Out of the way!" shouted a voice behind me. Leaving the chamber, led by Decimus, the assassins pushed past Cinna and me. They proudly held their daggers in the air. Caesar's confused and frightened lictors, stationed in the square below, scattered before them. When Decimus reached the foot of the steps, he put fingers to his mouth and made a shrill whistle. A moment later, his troop of gladiators came pouring out of the nearest theatre exit. Now it was clear why Decimus had devised a pretext for having his gladiators close to the Senate House. To fight for the survival of the assassins if things had gone badly, or to provide an armed escort if things went well. Suddenly, I spotted Antony in the courtyard below. He was alone. Staying far to one side, keeping his distance from the assassins, he rushed up the steps towards Cinna and me. His face was ashen. "Is it true?" he asked. "You see the bloody daggers, don't you?" I said. Antony moaned. Tribonius lured me away. I should have known. I should have suspected something. He shook his head. "His body?" "Inside," I said. "See for yourself." Antony swallowed hard and stepped past us into the Senate House. A few moments later he emerged from the chamber. Instead of his consular toga, he wore a plain brown tunic. Cinna peered at him. "Where did you get those clothes?" "From a scribe I found cowering behind Pompey's statue. He'll take good care of my toga and deliver it to me later, or else I'll find him and beat him senseless." Antony's consular toga would make him recognizable at a distance, a possible target. "They have no plans to kill anyone else," I told him. "So Cassius said." "And you believed him?" Antony snorted and hurried down the steps. "Where are you going?" I said. "Home, to Fulvia," he shouted, not looking back. Word of what had happened spread quickly. People began exiting the theatre, only a few at first, but then a great many at once. Someone fell. There was panic. People screamed and tripped over one another. Those at the front of the crowd saw the assassins with their bloody daggers, flanked by Decimus's gladiators, now openly brandishing their weapons, and turned back in terror, causing even more confusion, more collisions, more screaming. Then I saw Mito. He must have been in the theatre, for he emerged from the churning crowd, stared at the assassins, then ran past them and up the steps. I said nothing. He read my expression and knew the truth. The look on his face broke my heart. I tried to touch him, to embrace him, but he rushed past me. A moment later, from the open doorway, I heard his anguished cry as it echoed throughout the empty chamber. Chapter 36. Feeling utterly drained, I sat on the steps of the Senate House. In silence, Cinna sat beside me. For a while, as the theatre of Pompey was emptying, the assassins attempted to address the surging crowd. Brutus and Cassius seemed to have speeches ready to deliver, but the crowd was too loud and disorderly. Shouted rumours of riot and looting drowned out the would-be speakers. Rather than listen, the crowd hurriedly dispersed. At last, the assassins moved on. From the words they shouted to one another, I gathered they intended to station themselves atop the Capitoline Hill, a precinct that could easily be fortified. Centuries ago, when Gauls breached the walls of Rome and ransacked the city, a handful of stalwart citizens made their last stand atop the Capitoline, which was never taken. With the courtyard below as empty, I saw that Caesar's golden litter was still there, set on blocks. The four litter-bearers cowered behind it. It was almost comical to see such big, strong men so confused and frightened. At last, Mito stepped out of the Senate House. His face was red from weeping, but his voice was steady. He seemed hardly to notice me as he shouted to the litter-bearers, "You men, there, come, now!" Reluctantly, with Hipparchus leading, three of the bearers ascended the steps, the fourth ran away. The bearers followed Mito inside. A few moments later they emerged, carrying the body of Caesar in his blood-soaked purple toga. Mito led them down the steps. "Where are you taking him?" I said, following after him. "To his house, of course." Mito's voice was calm and quiet, almost matter-of-fact. The task at hand, delivering Caesar's body to Caesar's widow, had steadied his nerves. Rather clumsily, the handling of a dead body is never easy, Mito and the bearers managed to load Caesar into his litter. They rearranged the purple cushions so that he lay on his back, with his arms crossed over his chest. Then they drew the curtains shut. The costly cushions and drapes would all be ruined with bloodstains, I thought. Thus do mundane misgivings intrude on the most extraordinary moments. With Mito taking the place of the missing bearer, and Hipparchus across from him at the front, the four men lifted the litter and headed back by the route we had taken that morning. Cinna and I walked alongside. Of the grand retinue that had attended Caesar that morning, only we six remained. Mito stared straight ahead. Occasionally he shuddered as if he wept, but he never made a sound. People who had thrilled to draw close and get a glimpse of the dictator that morning now fled before us when they saw the litter approach and realized what was in it. Perhaps they feared that assassins with daggers would follow, or perhaps the idea of confronting Caesar's corpse fill them with superstitious dread. At some point, one of Caesar's arms was jostled and fell past the curtain so that it hung outside the box, limp and lifeless and smeared with blood. I watched it sway this way and that, horrified and strangely fascinated. I didn't presume to touch it, and neither did Cinna. So there it dangled, all the way across the field of Mars and through the forum. Young women, rushing home from their aborted celebration of Anna Perenna, saw the bloody limb and screamed. Men saw it and broke into tears, confronted with the reality of what until that moment had been only a rumour. From windows and rooftops I heard groans and cries of lamentation. But some, who saw the lifeless arm of Caesar, smiled and shouted with joy. "It's true!" one man cried. "It's true! The tyrant's dead! It's a new day in Rome! Come, everyone, follow me! Come hear the heroes who did this thing! They'll be speaking soon at the other end of the forum! Come hear what the saviors of the Republic have to say!" Mito ignored the man. He looked straight ahead and said nothing. The litter-bearers pressed on, until at last we came to the Regia. Calpurnia somehow knew of our approach. She came running out of the house, followed by female attendants. As a litter was set on blocks, she pushed Mito aside. She saw the dangling arm and let out a stifled scream. She pulled open the curtains of the litter, saw the body of her husband, and wailed with grief. I stepped closer, thinking to comfort her. She turned to face me, then beat her fists against my chest. "You were supposed to stop this," she screamed. "He counted on you. I counted on you. Why didn't you keep him from going this morning? How could you let this happen?"
"Calpurnia, you're being unfair," Cinna said quietly.
He put his hand on her shoulder.
"Don't touch me, you filthy beast. I know all about you."
She spun around and slapped his face. Cinna staggered back. His face turned bright red. He touched his cheek. At every moment during the long walk back to the Regia, he had been close to tears. Now they welled in his eyes and came spilling out.
"You there!"
shouted Calpurnia, glaring at the three litter-bearers.
"Don't stand there snivelling. Take your master inside at once. I won't have strangers gawking at him here in the street."
She paid us no more attention as she oversaw the conveyance of her husband's body into the Regia.
"I should go to my house at once," Cinna whispered.
"So should I," I said. "Mito, are you staying here with Caesar?" He shook his head, not looking at me. "He's work for the women now." "Then come with me. Bethesda and Diana will need us."
"No,"
he said sharply, and began walking resolutely back the way we had come.
"But where are you going, my son?"
He stopped and turned his head, finally looking me in the eye. "You heard what that fool said. The killers are giving some sort of public address. I want to hear what they say. But Mito, the danger. There's no telling what may happen."
"Good.
If the mob tears them limb from limb, I want to be there. And what if they incite the mob to join them and start killing Caesar's supporters? Then I shall put up a good fight. Mito, you're not even armed. And there's blood on your hands and on your tunic. I'm carrying the body."
"His blood,"
Mito said, his stern voice breaking.
"I wear it proudly."
Then he turned and strode swiftly away, Hours later, after darkness fell, Mito came home. He looked worn with care and utterly exhausted, too weary even to speak. He was still wearing his blood-stained clothes. Without protest, he allowed Bethesda and Diana to pull the tunic over his head, to bathe him with wet sponges, and then to dress him in an old tunic suitable for sleeping. He collapsed onto a chair beside a flaming brazier in the garden, too tired to stand a moment longer. After eating a bit of food and drinking some wine, he finally spoke.
They came down from the Capitoline.
Who, Mito?
The killers, most of them, or some of them. And among them were some who weren't in on the plot, but now are quite happy to join the men who killed Caesar and sing their praises. A huge crowd gathered in the forum, people who'd heard the rumour and couldn't believe it. Some wept, some danced with joy.
"Was there violence?" asked Bethesda.
"Not at the beginning. Decimus's gladiators were there to protect the speakers. I saw some fistfights. Most people were there to find out what really happened and what might happen next. That's the Roman way, isn't it, when there's a crisis? Citizens gather and listen to speeches. That's what sets us apart from the barbarians. Anyone can sack a city, Caesar used to say. But only a Roman can make a proper speech to justify doing so."
"They spoke, then, the assassins," I said. Mito shuddered and shrugged.
"Cassius, Decimus, the Casca brothers, several others, they all took turns boasting and congratulating each other."
"Boasting?"
said Diana.
"They've saved the Republic, don't you know? Killed a tyrant even more wicked than the old kings of Rome, a monster who ruled by fear and violence. Now everything can go back to the way it was before, back when..."
"Yes.
When, I wonder. When was that golden age they hearken back to?
Certainly no time since I was born, or in your lifetime either, Papa. It's always been violence and disorder, and the likes of Brutus and Cassius fighting among themselves and ruling over the rest of us. That's what Caesar put an end to, or tried to."
"What else did they say?"
"How did the crowd react?" I asked.
"Oh, the crowd seemed to love it,
for a while, at least. Cassius made a great point of promising to restore free and open elections. No more of having one man decide who gets which magistracy, and for how long. It was quite clear what he meant. Free meals and gladiator shows put on for the voters by candidates from a handful of the best families, who can get back to splitting the real power and wealth among themselves. Shameless pandering to the plebs, distracting them from the fact that Cassius and the rest are murderers, oath-breakers, who betrayed the man they were sworn to defend, who spilled blood in a consecrated space."
"No one spoke against them?" asked Diana.
"Not one man. They convened the meeting as if it were a legitimate public debate. But only one side was allowed to speak. Only Caesar's enemies were on the platform, men who hated him enough to kill him. Dolabella was among them. Can you believe it? The man Caesar insisted on naming as consul, despite Antony's objections, and daring to wear his consul's toga."
"Surely Dolabella didn't speak," I said.
"Yes, he did. Not for long, and not to much effect, but he wanted everyone to know that he was on the side of the assassins, now the deed is done.
too cowardly to raise a dagger himself, but smiling at every filthy word that came out of their mouths. What a viper!
Mito paused for a moment to collect his thoughts. Brutus gave the speech of his life, I'll grant him that. How Caesar would have loved that speech! Brutus must have been practicing it for months. Every rhetorical flourish and orator's trick in the book, praising his ancestor for driving out the kings, saying he had no choice but to do the same thing himself, appealing to everyone in the crowd who's lost a son or a brother or a father in the civil wars, saying their sacrifice was not in vain, for now the Republic will be reborn. He even took advantage of his injured hand, wincing and making sure we all saw the bloody bandage. Never mind that it must have been another of those vultures on the stage who cut him by accident. Cicero couldn't have done better. Cicero? Did he speak? Was he on the stage? Mito shook his head. I didn't see him. I'd have spotted that grey head. Come to think of it, I saw hardly any older men among them. They were mostly my age, the men on that platform. What did the crowd make of Brutus? They loved him. They applauded. They cheered. They practically blew kisses. Oh, it was vile to watch, how he made them hang on every word and bent them to his will. Caesar also knew how to do that. Mito seemed about to weep. I gestured to a slave to offer him more wine, which he eagerly accepted. But there was violence, I said. Earlier, you said something to that effect. Not at the beginning, you said. Yes, that's right. It happened so suddenly. Like that, he said, and from the way he turned his gaze to the dark sky above, I knew he meant the abrupt change in the atmosphere felt by everyone in the garden, the precursor to a storm. The wind rose, the smell of rain was on the air, the sky flashed, and from somewhere far away I heard a peal of thunder. There had been a storm the night before, it seemed very long ago, and now there would be another. After Brutus spoke, the crowd was clearly on his side. I looked around me in disgust, wanting to shake every smiling, mindlessly clapping man I saw by the shoulders. And then Cinna spoke.
Cinna?
I said. Oh, not your Cinna, Papa. The other one, the praetor. Believe me, two men could hardly be more different.
Yes, I've met that other Cinna, by accident thinking I was at the poet's house, and I saw him today in the Senate House, but not on the dais.
That's right. He wasn't among the killers, but he felt inspired to speak up for them nonetheless. People were shocked to see him on the platform. His late sister was Caesar's first wife, you know. He was Julia's favourite uncle before she died. He and Caesar are family. Caesar made him praetor this year. But what an ingrate! He didn't have a speech ready. He made it up as he went along. He started with some crude jokes about Caesar. So stupid I can't remember them. People booed. And then he began to gush about the killers, saying we must all vote them public honours, even erect statues to them. Make the Ides of March a holiday, he said, the birthday of the reborn republic. Celebrate it every year, an act of murder in a consecrated space. Then someone in the crowd challenged him, saying he was ungrateful for the robe Caesar had put on him. This rag, he said, and then he pulled off
his Praetorian toga, tossed it to the ground and stamped on it. People were outraged. The fickle mob. The same men who cheered Brutus rushed the platform and tried to grab hold of Cinna. There was a riot. I've never seen anything like it. In the blink of an eye, complete chaos. And Cinna? He picked up his Praetorian toga and rushed off in a panic, followed by Brutus and the rest of that rotten bunch. Decimus's gladiators closed ranks behind them while they retreated up to the Capitoline. Down in the forum I saw blood spilled, but I can't say how much or whose blood it was. I just wanted to get away as quickly as I could. It wasn't easy. Everywhere I went, lawlessness, looters, men with knives and cudgels out to settle scores, women screaming, gangs of rapists on the prowl. I had to circle back and make one detour after another. The darker it grew, the wilder the streets. Then things quieted down quite suddenly. There's a rumour that Lepidus has brought his legion stationed on the Tiber Island into the city, which is against the law, I said. As is murder, said Mito. I'd have gone to join Lepidus, but I wanted to come here first to make sure all of you were safe. He closed his eyes for a long moment. His shoulders slumped. I thought he might be asleep until he spoke. Papa, what did I see on the small table in the vestibule? The garment draped across it? What do you think? It's the senator's toga that Cinna, my Cinna, lent me to wear today. But why is it in the vestibule? So that I'll remember to return it to him as soon as I safely can. Return it? But what will you wear when the Senate meets, as they surely will? Maybe as soon as tomorrow. I sighed. Mito. Despite Caesar's intention, I was never formally inducted as a senator. That makes no difference. Caesar made you a senator. He entered your name on the list, and a senator you are, as much as any of those others. I don't think. If Dolabella is consul and entitled to wear his toga, then so are you. You were appointed by Caesar no less than he was. The first scattered drops of rain fell. Mito turned his face up as if eager to receive them. I heard another peal of thunder. This will be a huge question, he said. Are all the acts and appointments of Caesar still in force? They must be. Even the assassins will agree, since they were appointed to their magistracies by Caesar. Watch how they cling to their offices, the ungrateful bastards. Brutus, for one, will dispute that I'm a senator, I said, remembering his harsh words to me. Then ally yourself with those who'll agree to confirm your status. Antony, perhaps, and Lepidus, the man with whom you shared Caesar's Last Supper. I shared it with Decimus as well, the most treacherous viper of all. I'd rather not ally myself with anyone. But you must, Papa. You'll have to. Now more than ever, everyone must take sides. Not again, I thought, remembering all the suffering and horror I had seen over the long course of the Civil War. Had a new war begun? Like a vast spider web, jagged lightning bolts crisscrossed the sky. Not again, I said, but my words were overwhelmed by a thunderclap so near and so powerful that it shook the ground beneath my feet. Day 7, March 16th. Chapter 37. The next morning, as soon as I'd washed my face and had a bite to eat, I called for a slave to help me put on the toga Cinna had lent me. Mito was already gone. No one could say where. I roused my sleepy son-in-law from my daughter's bed and told him to comb his tangled hair and put on his best tunic. Whether as bodyguard or entourage of one, I wanted him to look his best when I paid a call on Cicero. Why I felt compelled to visit Cicero, I couldn't say. Perhaps, like the dutiful but often diffident finder I had been for so many years, I felt obliged to give him a final report, never mind that I hadn't accepted his commission, or that he already knew how the matter in question had turned out. We walked down the rain-washed street to Cicero's house. No sooner had I given my name to the door-slave than Tyro appeared in the vestibule. "I knew that had to be your voice," he said. "I was thinking you'd come today." "Then we shared the same thought," I said, "and perhaps you can tell me why I've come, since I can't myself." "Today's a new beginning." I could tell that Tyro was deliberately suppressing any emotion in his voice. He was too well-mannered to gloat over any man's death. "When there's a new beginning, it's only fitting that friends should pay calls on one another." "Am I Cicero's friend?" He raised an eyebrow. "You're mine, I hope." "And mine as well," said Cicero, stepping into the vestibule. "Gordianus, old friend, it's good to see you." It had been years since I'd seen Cicero in such high spirits, not since the first days of his short-lived marriage to his teenage ward. "But don't stand here in the vestibule. Come along to the garden, and bring that strapping son-in-law with you. That's where we've all gathered." As I followed him through the house, I heard voices growing louder and more distinct as we drew nearer. "And the look on Antony's face," I heard Cassius saying, "when he finally got away from Trebonius and came around the corner and saw us with our daggers held high, he knew what had happened in an instant. He was like a wineskin that's gone flat, all the juice sucked out of him. A pity you weren't there to see it, Cicero," he added, raising his voice as his host came in sight. In the garden, I saw not only Cassius, but also Brutus, Decimus, and scowling Cinna the praetor, all dressed in plain tunics rather than togas. They stopped their conversation and turned to stare at me. There was a long silence. "I thought the four of you were all barricaded on the Capitoline Hill," I finally said. Cassius put a finger to his lips. "Don't tell anyone we're here. This little party is strictly sub rosa." "We're not prisoners," said Cinna. "We're free men, free at last, thanks to these brave fellows." "Yet you are not wearing your Praetorian toga, Cinna," I said. "You're all in plain tunics. You've skulked down from the Capitoline at the break of day, incognito, to pay a visit to the man you left out of your conspiracy, before you skulk back. Are you finally ready to let Cicero in on your plans? Or are you here for his blessing?" "Cicero is essential to our plans," said Brutus, putting a hand on his host's shoulder. Cicero beamed. "No other man in Rome has his prestige and his reputation for honour and decency. No other man has his skill as an orator. We look to you, Cicero, to put into words the justification for what we did, to persuade our fellow citizens who may not understand the righteousness of our cause." "Like the citizens who chased you out of the forum and back up to the Capitoline yesterday," I said. Were you among them, Finder, stirring up trouble?
Brutus glared at me.
I was not, but I heard about it from someone who was there.
Let me guess, that adopted son of yours, Caesar's little Ganymede,
said Cassius. He smirked.
And what are you doing, wearing a senator's toga? Did you not hear Brutus yesterday tell you to take it off and never put it on again?
Friends, desist from bickering, said Cicero.
But Cicero, don't you see, said Brutus, this fellow still imagines he's one of us, daring to go about in that toga. Why not dress your son, Mito, in a senator's toga as well? I'm sure Caesar would have done it sooner or later. Yes, elevated even a freedman to the Senate, as a sort of thank-you gift to his... What did you call him, Cassius? Caesar's little Ganymede? Exactly. Shall we be seeing wives and whores in the Senate as well? Why not Cleopatra?
Yes, why not Cleopatra? Said Cinna, his scowl becoming a leer as he rudely mimed the act of penetrating someone from behind, clutching invisible haunches and thrusting his hips.
Now, Cinna, said Cicero mildly, we must be diplomatic in our dealings with foreigners, even with Egyptians. But I wonder, what is the Queen up to today? What must she be thinking, holed up at Caesar's villa outside the city, all her plans in shambles?
I imagine she'll scuttle back to Egypt as quickly as she can, said Cassius.
In my mind, I picture her as a beetle, rolling a ball of dung, onward, onward, always busy. Don't they worship dung beetles as gods in Egypt? Roll your little Caesarian all the way back to Egypt, Queen Beetle, and drown him in the Nile when you get there.
Cicero and Cinna laughed, but Brutus kept scowling at me. I wear this toga because Caesar bestowed it on me, I said very quietly, so as to get their attention. Just as Caesar named you to be governor of Syria, Cassius, and you, Decimus, to be governor of Gaul, and you, Brutus, to become consul in due course, will you give up those offices now that he's dead? Will you nullify the appointments of others and not your own? Will you have Dolabella for consul but not Antony? That could become very tricky, especially with Lepidus's legion camped in the forum. From the sobered look on their faces, I knew the rumour Mito had heard the previous night must be true. To bring soldiers within the city was strictly illegal, but which laws applied now and which did not? I looked at Decimus. You, he suspected least of all. Caesar trusted you implicitly. You dined with him one day and put a knife in him the next. Caesar spoke of the best way to die at that dinner, and your face betrayed no sign that you planned to murder him in a matter of hours.
A trick he learned from the Gauls, said Cinna. They're masters at showing no emotion.
And at feigning friendliness? I asked. When you called on me ahead of the dinner to introduce yourself, Decimus, what was your intention?
Decimus cocked his head. It certainly wasn't to make friends with you.
Scouting the terrain, my son called it.
Decimus nodded.
You might say that. You were a blank to me. I knew you only by hearsay. I was curious to see if you might pose any threat to our plans, especially given your reputation for perceiving what others do not. Were you a man to watch out for? Perhaps even an agent for Caesar? But when I met you, Any worries I had were put to rest. And an entity, Brutus called you, and so you are. No matter that you dare to put on that toga and traipse about in public. I looked at our host. There was something almost comical about the way Cicero was wincing and wringing his hands.
Friends, there's no need for harsh words, especially on such a happy day.
Come, Davis. It's time for us to go. We'll show ourselves out. Cicero didn't call me back. Nor did Tyro run after me to say farewell. I straightened my toga as I stepped into the street, feeling more awkward than ever inside it. Chapter 38. I arrived home to see a very ornate litter outside my house. Neither the well-dressed bearers nor the expensive litter looked familiar to me, until I saw a golden lion's head embroidered on the red curtains. That was one of Antony's favourite images, a link to Hercules, who wore the skin of the Nemean lion as a cowl and cape. It seemed unlikely that Antony himself would use such a vehicle. He preferred to walk. Those legs were made to be used, my admiring wife had observed, after seeing Antony run naked through the streets of Rome during the Lupercalia. When I stepped into the vestibule, the excited door-slave opened his mouth to speak, but I silenced him with my hand. "Fulvia is here," I said. The slave nodded. "But why, I wonder?" The slave gave me a blank look and shrugged, as if to say that the motives of a woman such as Fulvia were beyond his comprehension. "Beyond my comprehension as well," I muttered to myself. "What in Hades is she doing here on such a day?" It didn't occur to me that she had come to see not me, but my wife and daughter. I heard women talking. As I stepped into the garden, Diana rushed to my side. "Daughter, what are all these women doing here?" I asked, for along with Fulvia, I saw a great many other well-dressed matrons, among them Bethesda, who smiled at me serenely, looking very pleased with herself.
"Oh, Papa, you don't mind, do you? It's a rehearsal for the Liberalia, and we were supposed to do it at Fulvia's house. But that's simply not possible, or so she says, because Antony and a great many other men are coming and going and trying to organize some sort of meeting. Well, you can imagine why."
"Yes, I can. What do you mean, a rehearsal?"
"Oh, Papa, the rituals are very complex and must be carried out perfectly. And the Liberalia is tomorrow. We all need much more practice if we're to do it properly. We don't want to disappoint Father Liber, do we?"
She smiled as if making light of the matter, but in her eyes I saw steely determination. "Disappointing your mother, I mean to say Father Liber, of course, is the last thing I wish to do," I said.
"Then you don't mind vacating the house?"
"What?"
"Along with all the other males in the household, only for a couple of hours."
I grunted. It was too early in the day to visit the salacious tavern, even for me, even on such a day. Or was it? Was that strictly necessary?
"Absolutely," said Fulvia, who had overheard our conversation and now stepped up to me.
"Welcome to my house," I said, seeing her with fresh eyes. With Caesar gone, it struck me that the single most devious and ambitious mortal in Rome might well be the woman standing before me.
"Thank you, Finder, but your wife already welcomed us."
She laughed at the look on my face. "I'm teasing you, of course, but you will have to leave the house for a while." "You seem to be in very high spirits," I said.
"Why not? The Liberalia is tomorrow."
"Why not?"
Caesar is dead, and no one knows what terrible things will happen next, I thought. Will the Liberalia even take place? I should think, in light of what's just happened, and the uncertainty, in uncertain times, the only certain thing we have are the gods, she said, especially Father Liber. Of course, the Liberalia will take place. We may have to cancel the public procession, and we may not accomplish all we would like to. She looked past me into the middle distance as her voice trailed away. And every male must leave the house, even me. Especially you. Any man who witnesses the secret rites invites divine retribution. I would never wish the wrath of the Bacchantes to be visited on you, Finder. I briefly thought of Cinna's poem, and of Orpheus and Pentheus, both decapitated and torn limb from limb by the mad female worshippers of Bacchus, also known as Father Liber. That sort of thing happens only in the old myths, not nowadays. Is that correct? Let's not test the will of the god, Finder. You really must leave us while we practice. No man can ever witness the secret rituals of the Liberalia, not even the Pontifex Maximus. She stopped, realizing she was speaking of Caesar. Who would be Pontifex Maximus now? I looked past Fulvia at my wife, standing in a crowd of wealthy-looking Palatine-dwelling Roman matrons and their daughters, now her peers, I thought, with amazement. She had never looked happier. I sighed. Of course, I'll do what you ask. I suppose I can think of errands to keep the male slaves busy for a few hours. What parts of the city will be safe, I wonder, and Davis and I will think of somewhere to go. Fulvia touched my shoulder affectionately, and actually leaned forward to give me a kiss on the cheek. "How smart you look in that toga," she said. "If Bethesda was her peer, was I now the peer of Antony?" "The idea seemed absurd," Brutus would say so, "but the thought sent a shock through me. I was still realizing, in stages, the profound changes that Caesar had set in motion when he granted me the right to wear a senator's toga, culminating now in a kiss from Fulvia. As promised, I thought of places to send the male slaves. As they dispersed down the street in front of my house, and the door closed behind me, I drew Davis aside. "As for you, son-in-law, go to the Salacious Tavern, if the streets are safe enough, and see if my friend Cinna is there. Ask him for any news he may have, and tell him I hope to see him soon." "But aren't you coming with me?" "No, I have something else to do." "By yourself? Shouldn't I be with you, for safety?" "No, Davis, I'll be in no danger. Or rather, any danger I may face would be doubled if you were there, and neither of us could protect the other." "Your words are mysterious, father-in-law." He looked at me earnestly. "I have no idea what you're talking about." "Good. Now be on your way." So it was. Stealing into my own house, every house should have a secret entrance known only to its owner, and using certain secret passages, built during the Civil War, when it became sensible to have hiding places in the home, I was able to ascend to the tiled roof, and there to lie in a spot above the garden, where the sun-dappled, leafing branches of a tall tree concealed me from the women below, though I was able to see them by peering through the leaves. I did what I did on impulse, and not without a shiver. From earliest childhood it is
deeply ingrained in every Roman male, that he must never, under any circumstances, witness those religious rites that are to be performed, seen, and heard only by women. The rites of the Bona Dea are one example. Fulvia's first husband, Clodius, had once dressed as a girl and taken part in those ceremonies, and had suffered no immediate retribution, though some speculated that his fate on the Appian Way had been the goddess's deadly, if long-delayed, punishment. To violate the secrecy of any rites having to do with Bacchus and his female worshippers was particularly dangerous, considering the way a malefactor like Pentheus had died, ripped apart by rampaging maenads, including his mother. How did I justify such an impious act? For one thing, I was an old man. How much more life was in me for any god to snatch away? For another, I was simply curious, and would I ever have such an opportunity again? Still, I watched with mounting trepidation as the women in the garden below, led by Fulvia, began their practice. My heart beat so loudly in my ears I could hardly hear their chanting. What I witnessed over the ensuing 2 or 3 hours filled me with nothing so much as disappointment. Was this assortment of skipping dances, such as one might see any group of little girls on any street corner in Rome performing, repetitious chants accompanied by the ear-splitting music of shrill flutes, banging tambourines, and clattering finger cymbals, and banal incantations, rhythmic hymns that could have used a good polish from Cinna? Was this all there was to the secret rites of the Liberalia? I had expected something at least slightly shocking, or even very shocking, some titillation so unheard of it would make my hair stand on end, or some divine revelation so awesome it might cause me to spontaneously combust. What a blow that would have been to my wife's social standing, for her newly minted senator of the husband to burst into flames while perched on his rooftop, violating the secrecy of the female followers of Bacchus. Presumably, the ritual being rehearsed would take place in Fulvia's garden with no men allowed. Set up in the middle of my own garden was the focal point of this ritual, a painted wooden idol of the youthful, unbearded Bacchus, complete with horns sprouting from his thick locks. In one hand, the god held an upright spear twined with ivy, and in the other a cluster of wooden grapes. Instead of legs, the figure ended in a pole about the thickness of my forearm. This pole was set into a curious mechanism with various metal gears. When a rope was pulled by some of the women, the idol turned slowly around so as to face each of the surrounding worshippers in turn. I must admit, this device was slightly unnerving, especially as it rotated. The motion was, by turns, smooth and jerky, graceful and halting. The face of the idol was so lifelike that whenever it came into view I felt a slight shiver. The women put on costumes made of fawn skins, strung with golden beads, and headbands ornamented with jewels. Censers of myrrh were lit, filling the garden with fragrance. Myrrh, I thought, the residue of Smyrna's tears. Bowls of water were produced, and there was a great deal of ceremony having to do with the washing of the wooden wand each woman carried, and the wrapping of the wand with ivy. The idol itself was carefully washed to the singing of prayers. Fulvia explained that first this dance and then that dance would need to be performed before the statue, and then this dance again, and then that dance again.
The songs were all about Bacchus, especially about his death as an infant and subsequent rebirth. Many versions of the story exist. In the one sung by the women in my garden, baby Bacchus was the child of Jupiter and Proserpine, the consort of Pluto. In a typical fit of jealousy, Jupiter's wife, Juno, dispatched a group of Titans to destroy the bastard infant, whom they lured with toys, then viciously tore to pieces and devoured. Jupiter blasted the Titans with thunderbolts, turning them to dust. All that remained uneaten of Bacchus was his tiny heart. But that was enough for Jupiter to reanimate the infant demigod. Jupiter placed the heart in the womb of Semele, who gave birth to Bacchus a second time. Thus, the twice-born god is also called Bimeter, child of two mothers. I had forgotten the part about the Titans tearing little Bacchus to pieces. I thought of Cinna's new poem and realized that, long after the death of Bacchus, the maddened female followers of Bacchus were to inflict the same fate on Orpheus, and then again on the impious Pentheus, tearing them limb from limb, though neither of those victims would be given rebirth. Surely there was some connection between the way baby Bacchus was killed and the way his followers later killed Pentheus, some thread of reason that connected these bizarre, bloody deaths? I suddenly understood how certain rumours had come about concerning the secret female worship of Bacchus, namely, that in their rituals, these modern-day maenads not only sacrificed an animal, some said a baby, by tearing it apart with their hands, but also devoured the sacrifice, eating the raw flesh in an orgy of bloodshed and gore. Perhaps the Bacchantes of ancient days had practiced such rites, but nothing remotely like that took place in my garden. Instead, I saw a great deal of skipping and bowing and pirouetting, and, this being a rehearsal, the various components of the ceremony were performed again and again and again. And there was I, trapped on my rooftop, afraid to make my escape lest the rattling of a loose tile might give me away. Would the Bacchantes below tear me to shreds? I doubted it. But Bethesda would be mortified, perhaps even expelled from the group. I didn't dare move. And so all the starting and stopping and endless repetition of the rehearsal below me became a punishment in itself. Despite my dwindling interest, I was happy to observe that the conduct of my wife and daughter was above reproach. They carried themselves with dignity and grace, and the other women seemed to accept them as equals. Fulvia, whom I had long known to be a born leader, proved herself to be so on this occasion. Whenever any question arose, it was to Fulvia that the other women deferred. They obeyed her without hesitation. From time to time I spotted Bast, the cat, perched on the edge of the roof across from me, peering down. As a female, she hadn't been banished from the house, but she kept her distance from the worshippers below. Banal, I have called the ritual, and thus disappointing to a forbidden watcher who expected something dangerous. And yet, two or three times in the course of those hours, and for only an instant, like figures seen by lightning flashes in the dark, the women in their fawn skins below seemed no longer women, but something else, not quite human, unspeakably ancient, primordial, malevolent. In the same instant, the wooden idol of Bacchus seemed not to rotate because of a mechanism, but to move of its own volition. But as I say,
this weird